Well, there are disturbed people and adjusted people.
This is the Extra Hot Rate Podcast, episode 480 for the week of October 9th, 2023. I am B-Stripe Military Coat Sleeve David T. Cole, and I'm here with Rear Admiral Sarah D. Bunting.
You're an ass.
Old Yellow Stain Tar Ariano.
Hey!
And oddly defensive J2PLOS looking Dr. Tim Grierson.
You're making the comparison, not I.
Welcome to Extra Hot Great for another week. We will introduce our guest in just a moment. But first, a little pod business. We hit the 5250 milestone this week. Pew, 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 pew. And that means very soon we will be drawing a TV episode from the Forcening Pool. You sickos have already put some real crazy shit in there, so good job. Possibly exposing me to my first ever episode of Red Dwarf, just as one example. If you're not in the Discord, now is the time because you want to participate in this. You are in the Patreon. This also means Patreons helped unlock the Game Time Zoom party, so look out for details on that coming soon. And this means we are now, as of this taping, $241 away from our next goal, which will compel us to do a quarterly deep dive into this month in historical television. So if you've never been in the Patreon, do join us. You get so much stuff. If you're grandfathered in the $2 level, consider kicking that up to $5 to get more of that stuff that I just mentioned, and also help get us to that next gold. And to everyone who got us here, thank you so much. We love you. And to everyone listening to this, we love you as well. Speaking of people we love, he is the senior U.S. film critic at Screen Daily. You've also seen his bylines at the L.A. Times, and he preceded me at Cracked.com, and he's the author of This Is How You Make a Movie. Let us welcome back Tim Grierson!
Hi, thank you so much for having me back. I really appreciate it.
We're thrilled to have you to talk about the Kane Mutiny Court Martial. Stephen Merrick, formerly the executive officer on a U.S. naval minesweeping ship called, guess what, the Kane, is being, guess what, court-martialed for, guess what, mutiny.
I think we're done here. I think we solved it.
Merrick, who's played by Jake Lacy, believed that Captain Queeg, Kiefer Sutherland, had taken action during a cyclone that demonstrated that Queeg was unhinged. So Merrick relieved him of duty, but was Queeg unhinged and paranoid, or merely kind of a weird taskmaster? And is Merrick's own defense attorney, Barney Greenwald, Jason Clark, right when he says he thinks Merrick is guilty? And if so, why would Merrick do something so rash? The movie, which was released directly to Showtime/Paramount+ last Friday, is the last film from director William Friedkin of The Exorcist fame, but also many other titles. And it is based on the 1953 play by Herman Woke. We're going to talk about the whole thing, so let's do the Chen check-in. Tim, should our listeners watch The Kane Mutiny Court Martial?
Yes.
Sarah?
Yes, I think so.
Dave?
You know, I'm usually against woke media, but in this case, I'll make an exception. Haha, joke.
Sure. If this is your kind of thing, then this is the kind of thing you like. And if it's not, it's not.
Hey, sometimes you just want a simple courtroom drama. And I think this is a perfectly crime-lit example of something like that.
Well, let's get into it, because we've all seen screen productions based on stage material, like A Few Good Men, which very shamelessly steals from this, I would say. Tim, what do you think a screen adaptation needs to do to justify its existence? And does this version of the Kane Mutiny do that?
I think it sort of depends on the play itself, but I think in this one, I think you have to feel that it's not so stage-bound that you feel claustrophobic in the work, though there are some plays that, when they're turned into movies, being claustrophobic is part of the idea. I think why this one works so well is a couple things. One, I think Friedkin does a really good job in terms of casting, for the most part, in terms of finding the right actors to play people who can kind of just be the personalities of the characters they're playing. They don't bring a lot to it beyond just what's on the page, which I mean is a compliment, because they are playing military types who aren't necessarily, to your point about A Few Good Men, it's not that thing where everybody is the flashiest and the funniest and the most interesting. Mm-hmm. It's that they're all very good at their jobs and take their work extremely seriously. And that's the cast that Friedkin put together for this movie. And so even though it's mostly in one place, it's in the actual trial as it's going on, it to me felt so riveting. I watched this at home. I didn't see this in the theater. So I actually think it works really, really well because he moves the camera enough, he cuts around enough that you feel like you know each of the personalities in that room, even though it's not like we learn a lot of backstory or things like that about the characters. One of the things I like the best, I'll just say, about this version is I feel like we understand each of the people who are both on the defense side and the prosecution side, but also the witnesses that they bring in. You learn about them and their personalities just by the way they answer things and the way they talk about things, that it reveals character through action, as opposed to, you know, when I was 10 years old, I realized blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. This is not that kind of work. And so I found it pretty riveting, I have to say.
Sarah, you were nodding. You agree about the casting.
I do. When you look back at the people who have played the Captain Queeg role in the past,
yeah,
you see this history of like casting against type, like to have Kiefer Sutherland, a hyper competent torturer, Jack Bauer of 24, and then going all the way back to Humphrey Bogart, which like you would not necessarily expect. I read the book like a gazillion years ago. I think it was on my summer reading list. And I remember being riveted to that. But I hadn't seen an adaptation of it, so I wasn't really sure how much of it was going to be my sort of slowly recalling the book and things about the book that I enjoyed and how much of it was going to be this production. Most of my notes were talking about how amazingly well it did at evoking this whole backstory just through testimony. And Tim is right that the casting is a huge part of that. I think Kiefer is really well cast. I think they could have stood to use fewer people who were losing control of the Mid-Atlantic newscaster accent, Jason Clark. But generally speaking, I thought it was good. I thought there were some stagey, speechy moments, like the scene at the end that were like, okay, but this is a play and I'll allow it. Like, I didn't think that detracted. It was just a little bit less credible than other parts. So yeah, I thought that this was down to casting, but also that it just has good bones. Mm-hmm. And I think it's hard to create a production from this writing that isn't going to work. But, you know, the credit for not fucking it up in a question mark. Like, I thought it was good. I was paying attention the whole time.
If you liked all the casting and all the performances, did you also enjoy whatever Kiefer Sutherland was doing to his voice?
Okay, that
because
was one of the first notes I took.
I was trying to figure it
yeah.
out exactly what he was doing. And we watched the whole thing on the weekend. And then this morning I got up and I watched all the Kiefer Sutherland scenes again because I was like, what exactly is he doing differently? Is this, I just haven't seen him in a while and he's getting old and, you know, he's had some problems in his life and this is just the weird way he talks. No, this is what he's done. He's made some choices and what he's decided to do is his character is going to be 10% Popeye. And I'm going to play you a clip and you'll hear it. It's Kiefer Sutherland, wow, but it's 10% Popeye, including when you watch it, he talks, he raises the side of his mouth like he's got a Popeye pipe in it the whole time. Here is Kiefer Sutherland in the Caine Mutiny court martial.
Was this a standard watch change?
No, it was totally irregular.
How would you describe it?
Well, the most charitable description would be that it was an incident, a regrettable incident of the temporary and total collapse of military discipline.
Commander, please relate all the facts that bear on this unauthorized relief.
Okay, well.
I mean, you know how they tell you, you know you're not supposed to have any like milk or dairy before you go on stage. This is something that our drama teacher always told us. The cheese incident, as mentioned in the script, is that Queeg gargled with cheese before delivering his lines. He was making some choices. That's literally what my notes say. I'm not against it.
I just thought it was interesting that Queeg's whole defense is, I am what I am. for this. To Dave's point, I also noticed almost immediately, because he's one of the first characters we see in the movie, that there is definitely a choice. And I actually worried because I haven't seen Kiefer Sutherland in anything relatively. He was in the Claude Tyrone, that Netflix movie.
Oh, right.
He wasn't.
Oh, yeah.
He wasn't. And he wasn't doing this.
No.
But I actually worried sincerely, like, had he had a stroke, because I worried about the side of his mouth. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It seemed different. I wondered, had something happened to him? And then as the movie went on, I thought, no, I think this is a choice. I said in the intro that I think all the casting, most of the casting works well. I'm actually a little torn on Kiefer Sutherland in this movie, to be perfectly honest. I think he is, I don't want to jump too far ahead in terms of the conversation, but yeah. I think that he is definitely making a choice, and he is the only character in the movie that contradicts what I had said earlier, where everybody is very stripped down, very all business. By design, Queeg is supposed to be bigger, because we're supposed to ask ourselves, is he crazy or is he just hard-headed? And Kiefer Sutherland's performance is supposed to complicate that, where we don't know. I don't know if he entirely masters that thing of like, I don't know how to read this guy. It was more like, I don't think this performance is as confident as the rest of them are.
I agree. To me, his character is the kind of character, if you met in real life, I would be worried he would bring up corn pone and I wouldn't know how to react, because I'm not quite sure what corn pone is, but he does and he would never explain it. It would be really awkward conversation. I feel like that's the energy he's bringing to this. It's just that accent, that weird little just like slight popification of the whole thing. Just
popification. Yeah, I thought the same thing. It seemed to me like he's definitely, you know, obviously he's different on direct than he is on cross. And it felt to me like on direct, the first we hear of him, which is the part that Dave played the clip from, it seemed like he was deliberately putting on a kind of folksiness where he's like, he's trying to make himself, you know, to Tim's point, smaller, that he's just, I'm just a guy. You don't need to be scared of me. I'm just a gentle old man, which is like, well, you're only 56, but was there anyone else whose performance particularly stood out for you? Or let me put it this way, Tim, since you said Kiefer Sutherland was the only one that didn't work for you, was there anyone else in the cast that you would have swapped in for him? Because I think a Lance Reddick Queeg would be real interesting.
I'm torn on Sutherland, because I think that the performance isn't bad necessarily. Mm-hmm. I think it's an interesting choice, because to your point, Tara, as a big Law and Order fan, one of the things that's funny about watching this movie this week was like, oh, this is basically the Law and Order thing where you just get them angry enough where they start acting crazy. And then everybody goes, oh, well, clearly the guy killed his wife because he's so nutsy acting. And that's actually what Sutherland does. He starts off, like you said, super folksy. He doesn't seem like he's that bad of a guy, but eventually it's going to be. Out of curiosity, though, did people notice the thumb thing when he did it in the opening sequence?
Yes. When he's like just twiddling his thumbs. Yeah.
Yeah, you can definitely tell there's like this nervous energy to that guy, but there's a folksiness at the beginning. At the end, he kind of goes big in a way I don't think entirely works, but I still felt bad. Mm-hmm. I think it works because I did feel like, what a pathetic guy this is, like this poor bastard, essentially. Would I have preferred anybody else? I kind of like that Sutherland plays against type, though, I have to say, and I really, really like everybody else in the roles that they are. Like, Reddick is perfect, I think. I think Jason Clarke is kind of perfect. Mm-hmm. I think in some ways, Jake Lacy, if you don't know this play, you will suspect that Jake Lacy is up to something. Because I think sometimes Jake Lacy plays he seems like a normal.
Yeah.
He seems like a normal dude. Wait a second, Jake Lacy, you fooled me. Like he's done that in the past. So that's almost a bit of a tell if you know the type of roles that he picks. I loved Monica Raymond, though, also. Mm-hmm. I think she is absolutely terrific as the prosecutor in this. I don't know. I'm trying to think if there's another actor outside of this production I would have liked to have more as Queeg. The 24-ness, kind of like what Sarah was saying, like the 24-ness of Sutherland works well, because there were moments on that show where he's supposed to be the good guy, but you start to kind of question it.
Right.
That kind of works in here. I just feel like everybody's playing so muted, so restrained, and he has to go bigger. And the bigness almost felt weird in comparison to everybody else in the production.
I agree about Reddick. He was a standout for me. His quiet acceptance as Queeg just sort of unravels, I thought, where he just sort of seems like quietly sad. That was very nicely played. And I don't think I've ever liked a Jason Clarke performance as much as I like this one. He seemed to me to be the most natural, like especially in when he's on Cross. Like he just seems very casual, like not like he's throwing it away, but he takes this what can be very stagey language and makes it seem, it seemed very natural to me.
Yeah. And I also just add about the thing about Reddick in terms of directing and kind of not messing it up. Mm-hmm. I think there's like nice small moments when Sutherland is basically like unraveling.
Yeah.
Reddick sits back in his chair. It's like the only time he sits back and you can feel like this guy going, oh man, he's thinking to himself, hey buddy, you're burying yourself right mm-hmm. now. And he can't be as close. He can't even look. Yeah. He wants to get as far away as possible.
So Tim, Guillermo del Toro was kind of a backup director on this production, given, you know, Friedkin's age. And of course, he has since passed away. And I feel like the other most famous example of this was Paul Thomas Anderson backing up Robert Altman, who also directed a TV version of this yeah. play, too, backing him up on A Prairie Home Companion. That pairing feels more intuitive than Friedkin del Toro to me in this case. But you are the expert, so speak on that.
I will try my best. I mean, it is a weird pairing. I think it is, it's more of a respect thing and maybe a closeness between directors as opposed to Del Toro, this is your kind of movie as
right.
well. That was my thing, because you're absolutely right. And I think in some ways the Paul Thomas Anderson, Robert Altman thing was also that. Yes, you could see Paul Thomas Anderson making a movie, maybe like Prairie Home Companion, but they were also so close for so long that he trusted Paul Thomas Anderson. And Del Toro has talked about like how close they were, and Friedkin's talked about it too. So I think it was more like, I think in those types of situations when you're older and you need a partner essentially to kind of cover the insurance, because maybe they won't cover you because they're worried about your age and your health, you want to go with somebody that you really trust. Mm-hmm. And I think that's why he went with Del Toro in this case. Out of curiosity, has anybody seen the Robert Altman version of this?
No.
So I've seen parts of it, and I was trying to track down its before we did the podcast today. I don't want to jump ahead again because I think we want to talk about the ending maybe, but it's very Altman-esque in that it is much more guys talking to guys. Like in Friedkin's version, it's just the court case. There's nothing outside. It really is just the court case. In Altman's version, we see people talking beforehand. We kind of get a sense of like the whole community, that the whole world of where this thing is set. Mm-hmm. And it's much more kind of loose in that Altman style. And I was watching and I was thinking, and I absolutely adore Altman. He's one of my all-time favorite directors. I prefer the Friedkin version because it's tighter. It's so much sort of sharper. And it's interesting because Eric Bogosian plays the Jason Clarke role, which is a really interesting choice. Jeff Daniels is the Lacey character, and a longtime Altman sort of character actor. Michael Murphy is the guy who plays the Reddick role. Mm-hmm. Peter Gallagher, who had never worked with Altman, he plays the prosecutor in it. It's all men in Altman's version. Obviously, they made some changes for this version, but I think I prefer the Friedkin because it understands, like, in some ways, I think what makes the play so good is just sort of a just the facts, ma'am, kind of thing. Like, you don't need a lot of extraneous outside stuff. And Friedkin has the confidence that the play is interesting enough that he doesn't have to bring anything from the outside. Mm-hmm. That's why I think it works better.
Yeah, they do make some updates to it. The original is set during World War II, and this is, you know, present day. And then they move the action to the Strait of Hormuz. And yet, despite that, it still feels like weirdly apolitical. Like, it's sort of like it's happening outside of time, which also made me think of, you know, why this sort of a thing would be appealing to Aaron Sorkin, because I'm sure he would, you know, as we know, he would prefer to just talk about ideas separate from context, which is what this is like largely about. So let's talk about that ending. It's a big face-off between Jason Clarke and Lewis Pullman, Bill's kid, in a big celebratory party after the trial is over. So Tim, you brought it up. What struck you about that ending?
I did not know the ending going in. And so for me, it felt jarring in a way that I didn't like necessarily initially. And I found myself kind of going, oh, this is different than the rest of the play. I liked this production so much, I almost didn't want to go to a separate setting. I seriously actually thought it was a dream sequence initially. I was actually not sure because I was not familiar with the play going into this. And then when I realized, no, this is not a dream sequence, it threw me for a second. And once it was over and the way it kind of like dramatically cuts to black, I found myself kind of going, how do I feel about this? And when I started to kind of rewind it and replay it in my head, it worked better. A good buddy of mine, Justin Chang, who's the LA Times film critic, wrote a thing about this movie and said, like, it really kind of fits because Friedkin's whole thing, both in real life and in his movies, is he kind of always championed guys who just didn't give a shit and did what they wanted to do and believed in what they wanted to do. And that's kind of the way Friedkin was, or at least that's kind of how he liked to portray himself as a filmmaker. That ending makes sense in terms of how he does it, because it literally is just, I don't want to spoil it, but basically there's a thing that happens dramatically and it feels like a freaking like F you essentially to this, to the character that happens to, and maybe to the audience to a certain extent too, where it's like, I've sent you down this path and now this is how it ends. Cut to black.
Mm-hmm.
The Altman ending is a little different in a way that's very Altman, in a way that's not so freaking, but the ending threw me, but the more I thought about it, the more I really kind of respected the bluntness of it and it being the ultimate point of what the whole movie is about.
Mm-hmm. I did think it was cute that it sort of hinged also on someone selling their novel manuscript. That felt like something that was maybe the most old-fashioned or, you know, the most in need of updating.
I would just say that the Altman ending is really interesting. I'll only say that what we see in the Friedkin version, there is a little thing afterwards in the same scene, but essentially the blunt thing that happens at the end, that character walks out, they close the door, and everybody else just keeps going with the party as if nothing happened, which is a very interesting and a very Altman way of looking at it, which is almost like saying, again, be careful of spoilers, but
yeah.
I think the Friedkin movie is essentially saying one person is actually right and they're standing up for something. And the Altman version says, yeah, that guy might be right, but who cares in the end? It actually doesn't make a difference to anything.
It's
such an interesting contrast to what Friedkin clearly cared about in terms of his ending.
All right, it is time to go around the dial. Our first stop is with Tara.
Our Flag Means Death, season 2, TV's gayest pirate show, is back. Season 1 came up in the podcast a couple of times when it was brand new last spring. Steed Bonnet, played by Rhys Darby, is a Barbadian colonist who just decided one day he wanted to be a pirate, but a nice one, so he bought a ship and left his family. This is all based on a real historical person. I think we do not know whether he and the historical Blackbeard, played here by Taika Waititi, met and fell in love, causing chaos among the crews of both their ships, but that is what happened in season 1. So without spoiling too many details for anyone who still wants to start the show from the beginning, some regrettable decisions are made, some incorrect assumptions are also made, and when we start season 2, Steed and about half his crew are bumming around the Republic of Pirates while the other half are on Steed's former ship, which is now being captained by Blackbeard. Steed and company are trying to do relatively honest work so they can save up and buy a new ship, which is basically impossible since the work they found is running a pirate bar. There's a very funny montage in the premiere of all of them, like, just doing front of house, all basic different tasks in the bar. Blackbeard is just committing so much random mayhem out of pain and anger. Even his crew are like, this is kind of not cool even for us, and we are pirates. On the island, Oluwande strikes up a friendship and maybe more with a soup vendor named Susan, who is not exactly what she seems, and that takes the story into another direction. And while I know Steed really wants to be a pirate, I feel this season makes a strong case for him being most temperamentally suited to working in a ship's laundry and, like, gossiping with all the other ladies who were in there with him. That was maybe my favorite scene of the first few episodes. Season 1 had a lot of tough work to do just establishing this particular world, and now that the show has done that, I'm enjoying the ways they're playing around with it, particularly with regard to Izzy, who's played by Con O'Neill. He's Blackbeard's first mate, who really goes on a journey this season. Without giving specifics, episode 4, which drops this Thursday, is the one that Minnie Driver and Rachel House guest star in. They are extremely good. I won't say who they play, but I loved it. Dave and I have seen the whole season except the finale. It was quite enjoyable. I would say check it out. As you hear this, the first 3 episodes have dropped, and then I think it's 2 this week, 2 next week, and then the finale on the 26th. All of that is on Max. Dave, anything to add?
Only that once upon a time on this show, I pitched a TV version of Susan's story, which is now coming to fruition in season two of this show. So once again, I have made television happen. You're welcome.
You are a TV soothsayer. I reviewed the show at Cracked, and we will link it in the show notes.
All right, Tim, what have you been watching on TV lately?
So during the pandemic, as a gift for my parents, I got them a subscription to Netflix because they did not have it. And one of the things I have very much enjoyed is not really prompting them and just seeing what they see, what they randomly kind of come across.
Wait, hang on. You're going into their account and looking at what they
watch? No, like a normal son, I'm just asking them.
For the record, I would totally do that. I would give.
Yeah, same.
I will do a Tom Cruise Mission Impossible movie one thing where I just lower myself into their algorithm and figure out what they're watching. But no, I'll just ask them. I talk to them every week and I say, what are you watching? Mm-hmm. And the algorithm is starting to push them towards stand-up specials, which is very interesting because it's not something other than Bill Cosby's himself. You know, Bill Cosby, he's great. Other than Bill Cosby's himself, we didn't really watch stand-up as a kid, but they have really gone into it. However, I have discovered that it is very interesting to go back and watch specials that you do recommend to them and then realize what content is in those stand-up specials. I said, well, since you're watching stand-up specials, you should try John Mulaney, but you have to watch them in this order that I'm going to give you. Yep. Because they're kind of, there's almost like a narrative through line through the specials. You have to watch them this way. And God bless my parents, who I love to death. I could tell that they were not paying attention because next week when I talked to them the following week, they said, so we watched that John guy that you mentioned and we didn't like it at all. And I said to myself, oh, great. And I said, so which one did you watch? We can't remember the name of it, but he was talking about wanting his grandma to die. And I said, I said, Mom and Dad, I told you not to start with the new one. You have to start with the older ones because it tells a story and you have to do it. I will give my parents a lot of credit. They went back and watched the other ones and they actually liked them. And then they gave his most recent one another try. They liked it okay, but they still didn't like the grandma thing. What I have been doing is I have been rewatching the specials that they watch. And I, again, love them to death, but it is very funny to hear Taylor Tomlinson talk about her sex life and think, oh, right, I recommended my parents watch this. And you know, everybody, I think, has that story of the movie they watched with their parents when they were too young. Mm-hmm. For our generation, maybe it was like Pretty Woman or something, anything that's like remotely kind of sexy time. Mm-hmm. And like, oh, this is really uncomfortable watching with my parents. As a 48-year-old man, I'm very much enjoying talking to my parents where they hear things about whether it's mental health things or sex things or death things, and having conversations about that, because these are things we do not talk about in my family. Yep. But I am talking about them in the confines of, is it okay for Taylor Tomlinson to make jokes about her dead mother? Because it's her dead mother. It may make you uncomfortable, Mom and Dad, but it's her mom who died. We talk about life, death, sex, and all these other things that we never talk about in our real lives. We talk about in the context of these specials, which have been very fun and funny to rewatch and think, oh my God, my parents are watching this stuff right now.
Love that. What do you have to plug?
So a few things. You were very nice to mention my book, This Is How You Make a Movie. By the way, when I had a book launch party, I did have a cake that had the book cover on the top. Are you saying that was? Are you saying that's old fashioned?
No, that's great.
No, that's cool. That's cool, Tim.
What kind of cake was it?
Now I'm mad because I won't be able to continue this fake bit where I actually had a book cake, because I'm like, oh, I think they actually went along with it enough. I did not have a cake with my book, but it is a book called This Is How You Make a Movie. It breaks down a bunch of different definitions and terms that people talk about when they talk about film, and the book is for people who love movies or who are people who are getting into movies and want to understand the terminology. I use a lot of real film examples from the modern era all the way back to the silent era. The thing I most like about the book in terms of the feedback is people say to me, two of the three movies that you mentioned for this example, I knew, but the third one I didn't. So I'm really curious to check it out because that was my secret strategy, but I never actually sort of told people about that, because I always wanted one that people may not have heard of, but they knew the other two and they go, oh, I should check out this movie now. So that's awesome. Today, we're recording this podcast on October 10th. It is my very good buddy, Will's birthday.
Our buddy, too.
Happy birthday, Will Leach, who's been on the podcast several times. Mm-hmm. We all love Will. Will and I have been doing the Grierson and Leach podcast now for good heavens. I think it's been 8 years now. It's our weekly film podcast where we review new movies or requests of older movies from our listeners. The fact that anybody listens at all is always amazing to me. Will and I always enjoy doing it, but we never actually think we do it because we enjoy talking to each other about movies. And we actually get feedback from people going, I really like that show, or thank you for turning me on to this movie. And I think, oh, right, we record it and we put it out. I mean, we don't do it in a self-satisfied way, but we really just do it because we care about this stuff. And the fact that people actually listen to it and enjoy it is always a bonus.
Yep.
So when I talk to our listening audience, I always think, but I know nobody's actually listening to this. But no, people actually do. And then my last plug, I don't do as much music reviewing as I used to, but one of the books I've written was a book about the band Wilco. They have a new album called Cousin that is out now, and I'm going to be on the Wilco the Podcast, which is a fan site or fan podcast. These two guys who are best friends who really love Wilco and talk all things Wilco. The last time I was on to talk about my book, they said to me, next time a Wilco album comes out, we got to talk about it. That time has come. So I'm going to be talking to them about Cousin on their podcast called Wilco, the Podcast.
Sarah DeVonting, what do you got?
Well, I sampled The Restaurant. Not for the first time. I have been agitating for years for someone in the NBC industrial complex to put this relic on streaming, if only so that it can make some of that Boondoggle's money back for the principals. I did have occasion to track it down on YouTube. I'll get into why in a couple minutes. But maybe actually it's fine that it's not on Peacock. If you don't remember what I'm actually talking about, this was the super vaguely named NBC Rocco DiSpirito and Jeffrey Chodoro partner up for a restaurant, then have a long, messy, public, confusing breakup. Reality show that ran for two seasons back in the early mid-aughts-ish, and it is so very early to mid-aughts-ish, people. The sheer tonnage of hair gel on everyone, the dated plating, the hand-wringing commentary surrounding the show, Ray, the nature of reality in reality TV. It's so 20 years ago, but here's the thing. As reality TV, The Restaurant is actually kind of amateurish in a surprising way. It is a Mark Burnett joint. I had forgotten about that. It did seem odd to me when I was rewatching that as late as 2004, the ersatz, I have to get some exposition in here moments are as obvious as they are. I guess all the actors that the production hired as waitstaff weren't any better at acting than they were at waiting tables. And then weirdly, a lot of the drama that really does play out with exactly that shitty of timing in a real restaurant environment also feels manufactured as a result, when that isn't necessary because there's always some dumbass who doesn't know how fire works or how not drinking on the job works. And then there's the Rocco-Jeffrey battle, which at the time when I used to watch this back in the day, I seem to remember like seeing Rocco pull up at the reserved Hollywood parking spot in front of the restaurant in his Vespa with his stripy shirt and just being like, I'm never on your side. 20 years later, it does seem a little more ambiguous. There's nobody to root for because they're both dinguses, but it's also hard to know exactly what's going on or where we are in the timeline at any given time. So you also don't have quite enough information to hate people with authority, which is frustrating mm-hmm. for me as a somewhat vengeful viewer.
Yeah.
So it was a little bit of a letdown when I did finally track it down on YouTube, but most of it is there. Some absolute monarch taped it all off of Bravo or like CNBC. Remember when they used air it at like 2:31 in the morning and your TiVo's like, God damn it. I remember that. And watching it, it was a letdown, but it also really did bring me back to having a TiVo and literally popping popcorn and putting Old Bay seasoning on it to watch everyone in Gramercy be a shithead. Good times.
Amazing.
Yeah. New York Magazine had a he said, he said about all of this shitheadery back in the day. So we will link that in the show notes. And this all came about because my writing partner on Best Evidence, Eve Beatty, and I were talking on our mini podcast about food and restaurant adjacent crime in last week's docket. We had a special guest, Dr. Marcia Chatelain. Her excellent book, Franchise, is highly recommended. You can get into all of that and the demise of Boston Market and its delicious sides over at bestevidence.fyi.
Wait, Boston Market is out of business?
Hi, Extra Hot Great. This is Laura, and I'm presenting Scrubs Season 3, Episode 14, My Screw Up for Induction into the Canon. I know that this episode is nearly 20 years old, but a la Mademoiselle Caroline, I want to give the spoilers a ho warning in the off chance that you're in the middle of watching Scrubs for the first time. This episode focuses on the return of Ben, played by Brendan Fraser. Ben is the brother of Jordan, the ex-wife slash current partner of Dr. Cox. Back in season one, Ben was diagnosed with leukemia, was treated, and subsequently went into remission. Brendan Fraser would only appear in 3 episodes of the show overall, but it managed to establish realistic relationships with the cast, particularly a very believable lived-in friendship with Dr. Cox. I know we have some complicated feelings with Brendan Fraser due to his fat suit-wearing Oscar performance, but I'm hoping you bear with me. Why do I believe this should be in the canon? Number one, wise use of the secondary plot. Scrubs did not always know how to write for its female characters, but it does a nice job with exploring Carla's reluctance to change her name following marriage. She makes a deal with Turk that if he gets rid of a mole on his face, she will change her last name, even though she's conflicted about it. She latches onto a reluctant Dr. Kelso, who initially avoids her, then becomes a source of comfort for her. Clip one.
I'm just here to get a nasal speculum.
I just wish I didn't hate that mole so much.
I used one of these on my wife once. She's a terrible snorer. She used to keep me up all night. I made her have the surgery, but of course that just made things worse. But here's the twist. Now, whenever she goes out of town, I can't fall asleep without the sound of that gasping, wheezing woman lying right next to me. Trust me, if I ever met a Japan Air stewardess who snored like Enid, I'd marry her tomorrow. But here's the point. You might find out that thing you hate so much is the very same thing you miss when it's gone.
Though in later years of the show, they made Kelso much softer, this was one of the first times we had a glimpse of his more human side, and it was really nice to see. Number two, Ted. Even though this probably isn't Ted's best episode, I have to call attention to the late, great Sam Loyd. Scrub used his sad sack lawyer character judiciously, and Sam Loyd always made the most of his time on screen. Like the noise he makes when Ben takes an unexpected picture of him. Clip two.
Aw, let me powder my head first.
We miss you, Sam Loyd. Number three, John C. McGinley's performance as Dr. Cox. After going into remission, Ben went to travel and Dr. Cox admonishes him for never following up on his leukemia. JD is tasked with running Ben's labs as well as taking care of Mr. Taylor, an elderly man with an irregular heartbeat. When Dr. Cox returns from taking care of something for his son's birthday party, JD informs him of the patient's death, and Dr. Cox, blaming JD, kicks him off of all cases. 2 days later, Dr. Cox is avoiding his family, is on his 60th straight hour of work, and even uses a beeping man holding his watch as an alarm clock. He's clearly losing it. He's accompanied by Ben throughout his mental breakdown, who with time convinces Dr. Cox to forgive JD and head to his son's birthday party. When he arrives in the park, Ben has one final request for him. Clip three.
Listen, there's one more thing you have to do for me.
You can't keep me from getting drunk.
You have to forgive yourself for everything that went down the other day.
You're so annoying.
Yeah.
Okay.
Good.
There was your camera. Aren't you going to take some pictures?
Pictures of what?
You know, crying babies covered in chocolate, people singing happy birthday to my son who have never even met him before. You know, the whole routine.
Where do you think we are?
It's at this point that Ben disappears, and it is revealed that he is the one who died days ago and not the other patient. I know many shows have pulled this trope over the years, but this was back when it wasn't really yet a trope. I remember being shocked by the reveal and yelling down my dorm room hall to my friend who was also watching, saying, "Brendan Fraser died?" I know there's some things wrong with this episode. It's definitely a product of the early 2000s, and Dr. Cox's repeated use of girl names for JD and playing gay chicken probably do not age too well. It's very light on the janitor, who would normally be more of a presence, though he does have a brief moment while helping Elliot search for Carla. Clip 4.
Thanks again for helping me look for Carla.
No, no problem. I'll check the dumpster.
We're not looking for dead Carla.
Atta girl. You stay optimistic.
I've heard some other viewers comment that it was unrealistic that Ben would go from seemingly healthy to dead so quickly. But as someone who's used to routinely take care of leukemia patients, it is devastating just how fast someone can be gone. And while we're here, I have to agree with all the other medical providers that say Scrubs captures the feelings of working in medicine the best. I consistently see things from my work life reflected in the characters and their emotions. Finally, I do have to say that I think JD is literally too front and center in the ending scene of the episode. While it makes sense that he would stay with Dr. Cox until others arrived, it doesn't make sense that he's in the front row with the family at the funeral. Yet, it still doesn't ruin the episode for me because of the amazing acting of John C. McGinley. How he crumbles once he remembers his friend is dead is a moment I wish I could better convey, but it's truly visual. As is the stark devastation on his face as the episode fades out, that paired with the beautiful song Winter never fails to bring a lump into my throat, no matter how many times I have watched it. I feel that this episode is the strongest of the series, and it is routinely mentioned in articles referencing surprise twists and devastating character deaths on television. Scrubs could sometimes veer too hard in either direction, but this episode was the mix of humor and heartbreak that surrounds unexpected loss. I hope that you will consider inducting it into the Extra Hot Great canon.
Thank you, Laura, a.k.a. Bezor Laura. Tim, you chose this from our list of submissions. Please start us off.
I have to say, Laura's sort of soliloquy was kind of moving. I have to say, I was really kind of touched by what she had to say about why this should be in the canon. I remember this episode. I kind of stopped watching Scrubs after a while. But I remember this one. And one of the things that Laura gets absolutely right is when this episode aired back in 2004, back in February, I think, there weren't a lot of shows that had done this at this point. And it's funny to think like this is only a few years after The Sixth Sense, which is sort of like the king of all sort of twist endings. But I remember at the time when this episode aired, I hadn't had a chance to watch it that week. And a friend of mine said, "You have to watch this episode." And he wasn't that type of person. He's like, "You have to watch this. This is kind of amazing." And he wouldn't tell me why. And then I watched it with him. And it really got to me because, you know, maybe it was naive, but she made me feel better the way she was just describing it. I didn't see it coming. And it really got to me at the end. And I didn't feel tricked by what was revealed. It did not feel like a gimmick. And so I was really, really, really touched and moved by that episode. And Dr. Cox was always my favorite character on the show. And so that he was front and center in this episode also meant a lot to me. But I haven't watched Scrubs in quite some time. And I have sort of mixed feelings about the show as time has gone on, partly because of Zach Braff, who I have very mixed feelings about. Mm-hmm. Though I think, not knowing the three of you, I might actually defend him more than other people will, but regardless, mixed feelings about Zach Braff. So I was really curious to rewatch it because in some ways it was almost my, because I don't watch Scrubs anymore. This was always my favorite episode, mm-hmm. and I was curious to rewatch it and kind of reimmerse myself in the Scrubs kind of cinematic universe to a certain extent, and to watch it this time and to see sort of how it landed for me.
I agree. Fantastic presentation, Laura. And I appreciate that you brought your, you know, personal expertise to this, because I also have heard what she said that, you know, the show gets praised a lot by people who work in the field for its realism. And I know the whole time they had, you know, consultants that worked on every episode that were very attentive to this stuff. The idea for the show, I believe, if I recall correctly, is that Bill Lawrence, who created it, was friends with someone who was a doctor. And that was sort of the inspiration for, like, you know, on doctor shows, it always looks very glamorous, but in fact, like, you're broke, you're working all the time, you're exhausted, et cetera, et cetera. That doesn't really apply to this, but I appreciated that Laura brought it up. In the case of this episode, I agree with Tim. I didn't see it coming either. I'm not going to act cool. I was shocked seeing this the first time too. And so this time, knowing it was coming, it was interesting, always, of course, to see like how they built it in. And I thought it was pretty seamless. They were very careful in, you know, the writing and the performance. And one thing Laura didn't mention is, as good as Brendan Fraser is, and he's great at the emotional parts of it, it's also a very physical episode for him. He has to do a lot of like kind of slapsticky stuff, like when he's puppeteering Elliot and then he like commits to the bit and like pretends that she's, when she walks away, she's the strings of her puppet are like dragging him off the countertop, stuff like that, stuff with the cameras. Gay Chicken, yeah, not great, but not the worst. Like, there's definitely worser episodes of Scrubs than this in terms of that sort of stuff. I'm not going to defend it. How could I? But I hear what Laura is trying to forestall. And for me, I think the truthfulness of this grief story, I won't say it cancels it out, but it definitely mitigates the sort of early 2000s-ness of this, which, you know, we all lived through it. We unfortunately probably would not have been shocked at the time to see Dani, the Tara Reid character, at the funeral in her fucking clodhoppers, because it's 2004. this is how we lived then, and it's not great, and we can't ignore all of the truth about it. Good and bad. Sarah.
Well, first of all, excellent presentation. I agree with Tim that this was not a gimmicky ending, and I feel like it was earned. I agree with everyone who said that the acting is really good across the board in that section of the plot. Sarah Chalk, I just struggle to understand why that is a career. But yeah, like, this show generally is not for me at all. I am still kind of mad at Braff for Garden State. I will note his brother wrote a really good book, but Zach Braff, I just not my favorite Braff. I'm a Josh Braff guy. This just felt like unbelievably herniatically strained, except for when McGinley and Fraser were on screen. Brendan Fraser is perfect for this. Tara's right. He is doing a lot of stuff that's like, you know, it's not necessary, but it's perfect. You know, it's really well acted. I respect that it's trying to do something. It wasn't so much the like cringy early aughtsy parts of it that turned me off. It was just so fucking pleased with itself at all times. And the only time that it sort of pulled back and was trying to be like direct and unadorned and not quite so performatively proud of its own cleverness was in these scenes of like denial and grief. And even then, it was like the show couldn't resist goosing it with this soundtrack choice, which is, you know, lovely and sad and everything, but like, just get out of your own way. Like, you're stepping on my dick now and yours. Like, stop it. But with all of that said, this is a really compelling conversation to have about a canon prospect, because like the Scrubs greater cinematic universe, like, does it hold up otherwise? Bugsy's never fucking finding out. I did not enjoy this experience at all, but I think that I'm probably still going to vote for it, because if I'm told by people who know better, like, this is both exemplary of the show and the one of the best things it did, and one of the most notable things it did, that's worth putting in the canon. And it was a good presentation too. So interesting topic regarding a show that is just really not for me at all.
Tim, canon worthy or not?
I am very torn in the same way that Sarah is, because I don't think that the episode holds up as well as I remembered, but I do think it's canon worthy because I do think it's the sort of exemplary episode of the show. So I am going to say it's canon worthy.
Tara.
Yeah, same down the line.
Yep. Sarah.
this is the only one anybody's getting. So enjoy it. But yes, I am voting for it.
That means that Scrubs Season 3, Episode 14, My Screw Up, you are hereby inducted into the Extra Hot Great Canon.
Too weird?
Nah. Americans love a winner.
Yup.
And will not tolerate a loser.
Nope.
Winner of the week this week is Turn On. What the hell's Turn On? Turn On's the follow-up to Laughing. And you may know it infamously as the TV show that got canceled mid-episode. Stations, ABC affiliates here and there, just like let it get to the first commercial break and then pull the plug. There was some station that just hired a local organist to come in and play music over a black screen for the rest of the show.
Wow.
And so what is it, you're asking, and why the hell are we talking about it now? A few months ago, somebody anonymous put both episodes that they made of this show, a bit of one which aired, and put them on YouTube. And so everybody finally got to watch it that wasn't around for when it first aired. And it is fucking nuts. I watched it a couple months ago and then it disappeared. Now this week it's reappearing on the official account of the creator so you can monetize it. That's why everybody's writing about it. The premise is that there is a computer that is creating a comedy sketch show through artificial intelligence. And then we humans are acting it out. And it was 1969.
Nice.
And nice. They gave the creator of Laughing a blank check and said, have at it. And boy, did he have at it. You're going to watch this like now, and the pacing is going to seem like a little frenetic, even for today. Never mind like 50 years ago, over 50 years ago. The whole show is underscored with like contemporary 60s, 70s computer boops and bleeps and mm-hmm. Moog synthesizer effects. The whole show is shot in that Neo's Learning Kung Fu white void universe. And there are segments that last 1 second, 2 seconds, up to like maybe a minute some places, but that's like, and they're not connected in any way. It's just total fucking mayhem. I clipped this like little bit of the music they use, and it captures how like crazy this is. I'm just going to play it. This is just like a quick transition between skits. And it just has literally somebody manically dancing as they go in between two comedic thoughts.
Wow.
You'll hear that 20 times in one episode.
I don't hate that yet.
There is a certain rhythm to this show that sucks you in. It is not particularly funny, but it is super interesting to watch and see when you give somebody just like off the leash access to money and just like have at it. And like, I don't think anybody even watched it before they pressed the button to send it to the satellite and back down to all the affiliates, because damn, it is crazy. Like, there's no credits. There's no theme. It just starts. And then like every 2 minutes, they put another chyron for the credits, like evenly spaced throughout the show. Like you're just watching a skit and it's like edited by so-and-so. It's wow. Like, what is going on?
Was it?
I highly recommend watching at least the first one. Tim Conway is the guest. It makes very little sense, but it is just fascinating to watch. That's Turn On. It's on YouTube. Winner of the week. Wow. Sarah, who is our loser?
That all sounds like the Monkees movie.
Uh-huh.
Except
kind of.
Yeah.
That was edited to be even more try hard. Here's the actual loser. It's not the Monkees. It's Teresa Giudice, who tried to Bigfoot her way out of a traffic ticket. Apparently, the story was earlier this year, she got pulled over for like changing lanes wrongly, which like, to get pulled over for that in New Jersey, you really have to be like doing it in reverse.
Your car on the, is like, upside
truck
down
segment
somehow.
Of the dirt bike.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like you're driving with your feet, throwing bottles of beef eaters at like it's, you know. So she got pulled over and then apparently she like handed a quote family business card and like tried to big shot the state trooper. Her attorney, same guy that you saw during the you know, Lamentations seasons when she was fixing to go to jail, James Leonard was like, why is this body cam footage being released now? She handed over a PBA card. What is the deal? People do this all the time. Which is true. So I can't decide if the loser is her, I mean, always it's her. Mm-hmm. If it's the Stadies who decided to release this footage, or if it's me for telling you about this, who can say?
Who can say indeed? Do you know what time it is?
Is it game time?
It is.
Who can say?
That fresh new season smell. It's an all new season of Game Time. Today we are playing The Nominees Were from Meredith, who earns himself an extra credit on the topic of their choosing, plus a free shirt from the EHG store at throughmethods.com. She writes, "It is a truth universally acknowledged that an actor who has achieved success on the small screen must be in want of success on the big screen. Some achieve that success and are rewarded for their efforts. In this game, I will read a description of two characters played by the same actor, one from TV and one from a movie for which said actor was nominated for an Oscar.
Ooh.
Name the actor, the TV show, and the movie for 1 point each. There are no hints, and you can only answer once. Partial credit is possible. So if you get 2 out of 3, you still get 2 points.
Okay.
And then I will ask you a follow-up question for an additional point that has something to do with whether they won the Oscar or not.
Ooh.
Here's an example. I'm going to read you their TV role and their movie role. TV role: a man who poses as a woman to move into the only apartment he can afford. And the movie role is a lawyer dying of AIDS who sues his employer for wrongful termination. The actor is?
Tom Hanks.
Correct. Tom Hanks. And the TV show?
Bosom Buddies.
Bosom Buddies.
You are correct. And the movie?
Forrest Gump, just kidding, Philadelphia.
Philadelphia is correct. That would get you 3 points.
Joe versus the volcano.
Did Tom Hanks win the Oscar for Philadelphia?
Yes.
That would get you 4 points, and that's how you play. All right, we're not going to do steel meals. We're not going to do any gross worth equalizer challenge zones today. Let's throw it to Piggy, the CR order.
We will start with Sarah.
All right, we're going to go Sarah, Tim, Tara. We got 30 questions. We'll see how far we get. We are running a bit late. Are we ready to play The Nominees Were?
Yes.
Yes.
All right, here you go. Sarah D. Bunton. TV role, a Baltimore detective. Movie role, a mother of a pair of pugilist brothers. I was quite the pugilist in my college days.
Mm-hmm. I wish everybody could see
All right, actor.
See the fists waving.
Yes, speaking of
the actor is
comedy.
Ms. Melissa Leo.
Correct. All right, TV show in question.
Homicide: colon, Life on the Street.
Movie.
I think it was just The Fighter. Was it just The Fighter?
Correct. Okay. And did she take home the Oscar?
Did she? Yes, I think she did.
That is worth maximum 4 points. Well done.
They considered and they decided yes.
To Tim, a Catholic sister with a supernatural ability on television and in the movies, a factory worker who fights to unionize.
So the actor is... can I do them in a different order?
You can do whatever order you want.
Okay, so it's The Flying Nun. And it's Sally Field is the actor.
Correct. Movie.
Can I hear the movie again?
A factory worker who fights to unionize.
Is it Norma Rae?
You are correct. And did she win the Oscar for Norma Rae?
I'm going to say yes.
You are correct. That's another maximum 4 point answer. Pressure's
really
on Tara.
I liked her.
TV role, Tara. A dim but lovable bartender. Movie role, one of America's foremost purveyors of pornography.
Mm-hmm. That's the actor's Woody Harrelson. The show is Cheers. The movie is The People versus Larry Flint.
All right. Did Woody Harrelson take home the Oscar?
No.
You are correct. Anybody want to guess who he lost to? Do you know? He lost to Jeffrey Rush.
That's
Shine.
Right.
Oh, yeah. Right.
Back to Sarah. TV role is a dim-witted airport handyman. Movie role, a womanizing groom-to-be on a winery vacation with his best friend.
Oh, boy. This is Thomas Hayden Church.
Correct. TV
was
show
on Wings.
Yes. Movie?
What the fuck was the name of that Merlot Shaggin?
That was it. Merlot Shaggin.
Merlot.
That was the original name. Foreign Markets.
That is called, it was just on TV the other day, too. It's like Become a Poppy Fields movie. Starring Paul Giamatti in it.
I need an answer.
Gave you so much trivia about Virginia Madsen, too. Remind me what it was called.
All right. Anybody know that one?
Sideways.
Oh, yes. Sideways. Okay. Now, you still got a chance. Did he win the Oscar for his performance in Sideways?
No.
You are correct. He lost to Morgan Freeman, Million Dollar Baby.
That'll happen.
Back to Tim. Your TV role is a doctor at a Boston hospital. Your movie role is a corrupt LAPD narcotics cop. Who are we talking about?
Okay, so you're talking about Denzel Washington.
You are correct.
The movie is... Did you say a corrupt cop?
A corrupt LAPD narcotics cop.
Okay, that's Training Day.
Correct.
And the TV show is St. Elsewhere.
Yes, all right. Did Denzel Washington take home the Oscar for that?
He did.
He did. Yes, he did. Yes, 4 points. Nicely done. Tara.
Yes.
TV role, a father of three and the owner of a funeral home. Movie role, a college professor who travels to New York to attend a conference and finds a young immigrant couple living in his apartment.
That is Richard Jenkins. TV is 6 Feet Under. Movie is The Visitor.
Did he win the Oscar?
No.
Correct. Lost Should to have. Sean Penn.
Yeah, he was milk. Great. I agree.
Sarah D. Bunting, your TV role. A go-go dancer among other characters in a sketch comedy show. Movie role. A young woman whose dentist boyfriend pretends to have a wife. Who are we talking about?
Dentist boyfriend pretends to have a wife. Jesus. I have no idea. Jennifer Lopez?
Nope. It's going to make it very difficult to answer the rest. So we'll just call you on that one. All right. No points there. Anybody know who we're talking about? A show we've already mentioned on this podcast.
Laughing.
That is Goldie Hawn from Laughing and Cactus Flower. And she did take home the Oscar for that. All right. Back to
Never
Tim.
Never would have gotten any of that.
Cool.
TV role, a homicide inspector in a prominent U.S. city. Movie role, a greedy stockbroker.
Okay, so the actor is Michael Douglas. The show is San Francisco. The movie is Wall Street.
The movie is Wall Street. Did he take home the Oscar for Wall Street?
He did.
He did. You want to revise your answer for that TV show?
I
feel like you figured out what you missed there.
The man who was the cop in San Francisco.
Perfect. That is, in fact, the name of the show. Formerly known as The Streets of San Francisco. All right, Tara.
Yes.
A Howard University graduate and publisher of an indie magazine on television and the matron of a woman's prison in the movies.
Okay, it's Queen Latifah. The show is Living Single. The movie is Chicago.
Oscar?
No, she lost to her co-star, Catherine Zeta-Jones.
You are correct. Sarah.
Yeah.
On TV, a meth-dealing former chemistry teacher. In the movies, a blacklisted screenwriter.
Okay, it's Bryan Cranston. Breaking Bad.
Breaking Bad is the show. Movie.
This movie does not exist. I mean,
Trumbo?
Sorry, what was that?
Trumbo.
Trumbo, correct. Did he take home the Oscar for Trumbo? You are correct, yes.
Trumbo
lost it to Leonardo DiCaprio in The Revenant. All right, back to Tim. On TV, a nerd amongst football players at a Texas high school, and in the movies, a wealthy ranch owner who marries a single mother, much to the chagrin of his creepy brother.
Can you do the TV show again?
A nerd amongst football players at a Texas high school.
And then the movie again, sorry.
A wealthy ranch owner who marries a single mother, much to the chagrin of his creepy brother.
And we even mentioned his name earlier in the episode. Can I remember his name? The movie is The Power of the Dog. The TV show is Friday Night Lights.
Yes.
He is an actor.
Yep.
We literally just talked about him.
Did we? I don't remember, but I'm not going to say you're incorrect.
No, we talked about it in the previous meeting I was a part
in
of.
In the meeting Tim and I were in before this call.
Which is why Tara is laughing because... I see. Because we were talking about Game Night, because he's in Game Night. He did not win the Oscar, I can tell you that, while I'm stalling here. And his stupid name is Jesse Plemons.
Wow.
There you go.
That
By
was
the
impressive.
Way, as fellow podcast host, I'm sure you can appreciate this. There's nothing worse than the slow death of seeing a person's face and you can see the names, but the letters won't fill in. And you think, if I just keep talking, my stupid old brain will eventually.
Welcome to the soundboard, that clip.
That's what my brain was doing in that moment when I was thinking JP something.
Back to it with Tara's question.
Hello.
On television, a New York City teenager sent to live with her grandmother in a small town. And in the movies, a famous blonde bombshell of yesteryear.
Oh, no. Sent to live with her grandmother. Oh, no. I know I shouldn't. Oh, okay. Got it. Thank God. My stupid brain.
Right. Who are we talking about?
We're talking about Michelle Williams.
Yep.
It was. The show is Dawson's Creek. The movie is which one is it? My Week with Marilyn? Okay.
All right. Did she get the Oscar for that?
No.
You are correct. She lost to Meryl Streep for The Iron Lady.
Ugh.
As you do.
Terrible movie. Yeah,
very, very bad movie. I mean, the Marilyn movie is pretty bad, too.
All right. Back to Sarah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
A single woman who gets a job as a news producer on television. Good save, Dave. And a grieving mother who fails to connect with her surviving son in the movies.
Oh, okay. It's Mary Tyler Moore on The Mary Tyler Moore Show.
Yep.
And In Ordinary People.
Yes. Oscar for Ordinary People.
Yeah, I think so.
No, she lost to Sissy Spacek for Coal Miner's Daughter.
Oh, sure.
Oh, yeah, she should have won that, though.
All right, Tim. On television, a sweat hog. In the movies, a hitman tasked with entertaining his boss's wife.
This movie also came up in that meeting.
Meeting sounds like that.
The actor's name is John Travolta. Yep. Can you see the movie again?
A hitman tasked with entertaining his boss's wife.
That movie is Pulp Fiction.
Yep. TV show?
The TV show is Welcome Back, Cotter.
All right. Now, did he take home an Oscar for his work in Pulp Fiction?
He did not.
He did not. No, he lost to Martin Landau for Ed Wood. All right, Tara, this will take us into our score break. On TV, you have a teenage model. In the movies, you have a woman who falls in love with the prison warden who oversaw her husband's execution.
Oh, thank you, Sarah's pick for again with this Patreon. That is Halle Berry. The TV show is Living Dolls. And the movie is Monster's Ball.
Correct. And did she take home the Oscar for Monster's Ball?
She did.
Yeah, 4 points. All right. That is over halfway done. Let's get the scores, please.
It's quite close. Sarah D. Bunting has 14. Tim has 19. I have 20.
All right, everybody has 3 questions left. Let's start it off with Sarah's. Ooh. This is what you got. A West Philadelphia teenager who was sent to live with his auntie and uncle in California on TV. And in the movies, the father of 2 champion tennis players. Who are we talking about?
We're talking about Will Smith.
Yes.
Who was in The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air. And The Slap. Just kidding. King Richard, I think, was the name of that.
Yes. All right. Oscar for King Richard?
Yeah.
Yes. 4-point answer. Nicely done. Back to Tim. You have on television an alien. In the movies, the therapist to a brilliant yet troubled young man.
Okay, so it's Robin Williams.
Yes. Nanu, nanu.
It's Mork and Mindy.
Jazz bot.
Can you read the film description again?
The therapist to a brilliant yet troubled young man.
Okay. That is Good Will Hunting.
No, I'm sorry. It's Patch Adams. No. Did he win for Good Will Hunting?
He did, in fact, win for Good Will
Hunting. All right. 4-point answer. Nicely done. Tara.
Ooh, yes.
On television, a army doctor in the Korean War. In the movies, a U.S. senator investigating a wealthy entrepreneur.
Oh, God. This is Alan Alda. The show is MASH. The movie is The Aviator.
And did he win the Oscar for the Aviator?
No.
Lost to Morgan Freeman again. Million Dollar Baby. Morgan Freeman burying all the bodies. Sarah.
Yeah.
Identical half-sisters on television. In the movies, a woman diagnosed with early onset Alzheimer's disease.
Identical half-sisters?
I think you got the toughest question. On both sides of it, frankly.
Oh, God.
I'll give you a hint. You don't like her.
If you think you like this person, you don't.
I mean, I have two choices and I don't like either of them.
Throw one out.
All right. Coin flip. Julianne Moore.
Hey!
All right. You got the actor. Can you piece together any part of the TV show or the movie?
The movie, I want to say, it's not Go Ask Alice. It's About Alice. Let's try that.
Very close.
So close.
Still Alice.
Still Alice.
Fuck Alice. And the TV show is, I don't know what the TV show is.
It's a soap, but I forget which one.
It is
Guiding
a soap.
Light?
Yeah. As the World Turns.
Right.
Oh.
All right, 50-50 for a point, Sarah. Still Alice Oscars?
No, I don't think she did.
She did?
That bitch.
I hate her.
I hope my Julianne Moore poster behind me is not making Sarah mad this entire time. I feel bad now. It's a triggering thing.
I don't actually hate her that much. Just like the myth of fingerprints, I just wanted to slap her even when she wasn't in the scene.
And isn't that her husband's
took a while
fault,
to
though?
End.
That's true.
I feel like we should blame Bert, I feel like, for that.
Probably.
I mean, she married him, so she made her choices. But
she sure did.
All right, Tim. TV role, maybe the only white student at a historically black college. And in the movies, the underestimated girlfriend of a fish out of water defense attorney.
Okay, so it's Marissa Tomei. The movie is My Cousin Vinny. I don't even know. Don't even have a guess.
All right, did she win for Cousin Vinny?
She did.
Famously, yes. All right, what's that show, everybody?
A Different World.
A Different World.
All right, to Tara. The boyfriend of an aspiring writer living in NYC on television.
Sure.
In the movies, a Jewish policeman who joins forces with an African-American colleague to infiltrate the KKK.
Oh, that's Adam Driver. The show is Girls. And the movie is Black Klansman.
You are correct. And did he win the Oscar?
No.
You are correct. Last question for everybody coming up. So let's quickly get the scores, please.
Okay. Sarah has 19. Tim has 26. I have 28.
Ooh, all right. Let's do it. With 4 points apiece at stake. Nobody knows the winner yet. Here we go. Sarah D. Bunting. The teenage victim at the center of a murder mystery on television. And in the movie, she played an actress who was the mistress of a wealthy publishing magnate. You absolutely positively have watched the TV show part of this.
Okay. But then I'm not going to know the movie. All right. I'm relieved that it apparently is not. Twin Peaks. Let's guess Amanda Seyfried.
You are correct. So the show is?
That television program is Veronica Mars.
Correct. All right, now for the movie.
What is the description? Once more, I'm so sorry.
She played an actress who was the mistress of a wealthy publishing magnate.
I feel like I can picture this, but I don't remember. So I don't know.
This is the one I wanted to yell when it was Trumbo, because I've mixed up these movies all the time. They are not the same, apparently.
It's the Mank.
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 Oh, sure. Right. Of course.
Did she win for Mank?
She did not.
She did not indeed, yes. All right, here we go. Four. Tim, on television, the White House press secretary. In the movies, the mother of a disgraced figure skater.
So the actor's name is Allison Janney?
You are correct.
The movie is I, Tonya?
Yep.
And the TV show is The West Wing.
You are correct. Now, for your full 4 points, did she take home an Oscar for I, Tonya?
Sadly, yes, she did.
I agree.
Like Allison Janney a lot, that is not a great performance.
She has Laurie Metcalf's Oscar.
That is correct.
Mm-hmm.
All right, last question. It is for Tara. The regional manager of a paper company on television and a millionaire wrestling enthusiast at the movies.
That's Steve Carell in The Office and Foxcatcher.
Foxcatcher is correct. Did he win the Oscar?
No.
No, he did not. All right, that
oh,
is
God, that schnoz.
Regulation. Yeah. Let's get the final scores.
Okay, Sarah finished with 22. Tim had 30. I had 32.
Oh, that's the squeaker. Nice. Well done, everybody. But Tara takes the day.
Tara.
All right, guys, that is it for this episode of Extra Hot Great. We cross-examined the latest adaptation of the Kane Mutiny court-martial and did so navally. Before going around the dial with stops at Our Flag Means Death, stand-up specials that Tim's parents watched and sometimes hated, the restaurant, and I'll tell you where I think I am. I'm at the part where I say Pisa Laura got scrubs my screw-up into the canon. We crowned winners and losers of the week, and Tara was the winner of this week's Game Time from Meredith. Next up, it's the fall of the House of Usher on this Friday's Extra, Extra Hot Grate, along with our back-in-action 2024 TV preview. Remember,
we're listening.
I am David T. Cole, and on behalf of Tara Ariano,
I'm just a third-class petty officer,
Sarah D. Bunting.
Now I'll never meet Bob Saget.
And Tim Grierson.
I'm careful in my use of terminology. I did not use the term sick.
Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time right here on Extra. Not great.
Well, that was good. That was good listening.
Thank you.
Yep.
Wait, Boston Market is out of business?